Oh, it's great to be back again at the Perimeter Institute. I was here before and very favorably impressed with the place. With one exception, and that's technological overkill. What used to be really easy, showing transparencies, has now been now become a rather critical and difficult art. And I may be forced kicking and screaming to go to PowerPoint in the next conference. I really don't like that, but that seems to be the way things go. Well, I'm going to be talking about the statistical interpretation of quantum mechanics and its relation to probability theory. There are, I'm sure we'll see in this conference, several recurring themes about the interpretation of the quantum state, one of them being individual versus ensemble, another we've already heard, ontic versus epistemic. And in my talk, I'm going to review the arguments. Some of them are quite old, others are more new, as to why the quantum state is best interpreted as a description of an ensemble of similarly prepared systems and a generator of probabilities for them. In his discussions of the interpretation of quantum mechanics, Niels Bohr advocated the use of the term phenomena. The word phenomenon means that which is perceived or observed. Or another example of the definition of the word phenomenon is a particular fact or occurrence. I looked it up in the dictionary before doing this talk. A particular fact or occurrence is an example of a phenomenon. And Niels Bohr was quite correct in emphasizing the importance of this concept, but it's rather ironic that quantum mechanics does not describe the phenomenon. It only describes the probabilities of the various possible phenomena. It doesn't describe the events, but it gives you the probabilities of the possible events. I'm not sure how Niels Bohr would react if he could hear me saying this, but I think it's an ironic fact that his emphasis on phenomena sort of came around and bit him in the end. I'll be arguing in favor of an ensemble interpretation, but even if we agree on an ensemble interpretation, and even if we agree that the state vector is best thought of as a generator of probabilities, we're still not finished. Because just as there's many interpretations of quantum mechanics, there's also many interpretations of probability, or I think a better word is there are many kinds of probability. And we have the next question, what kinds of probability are quantum probabilities? And if I have time, I'll try to say something about the ontic versus epistemic controversy, but that's sort of an afterthought, so let me get on with the main part of the talk. One of the oldest and clearest statements of the statistical interpretation was by Albert Einstein. I see we got some problems there. Oh, well, you can mainly read it. I'll read it out to you. He said in something he wrote in 1949, "The attempt to conceive the quantum theoretical description as the complete description of the individual systems leads to unnatural theoretical interpretations, which immediately become unnecessary if one accepts the interpretation that the descriptions refer to ensembles of systems rather than individual systems." One of the oldest arguments in favor of this point of view, and one which Einstein himself favored, is the Schrodinger cat paradox, which no doubt you've all heard of too many times. Schrodinger even said in a letter to, sorry, Einstein said in a letter to Schrodinger, the prettiest way to show this, namely the ensemble point of view, is by your example with the cat. Old stuff, but let me just put it down for you. The idea, of course, is that you have an experimental apparatus in which there's an unstable atom and a cat. And I screwed up myself, I'm sorry. I gave you the wrong transparency. I got them in the wrong order. Here it is. Unstable atom and the cat. If the atom decays, poison is released, kills the cat. One half life of the atom later, you have a 50% probability that the atom's decayed. The state vector will be a term involving the undecayed atom and the live cat, and another term involving the decayed atom and the dead cat. And the problem is, what meaning are we to attribute to a state vector that is a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct terms? And my view of this old paradox is that it serves as a kind of a filter to interpretations of quantum mechanics. Different interpretations of quantum mechanics have different degrees of merit and different degrees of robustness in the light of arguments of this sort. To some interpretations of quantum mechanics, this is a really, really serious problem, and to others, it's not. There is a widespread propaganda to the effect that environmental decoherence solves this problem. I think that is entirely mistaken. And I give you the next transparency, which is Schrodinger's cat problem with the environment taken into account. Instead of having the two terms that I showed on the previous slide, we have two terms, an undecayed atom, a live cat, and an environmental state E1, plus a term involving decayed atom, dead cat, and environmental state E2. And we have exactly the same problem. What is the meaning of a state vector that is a coherent superposition of macroscopically different terms? Decoherence is irrelevant to this fundamental problem. If anything, it makes it a little bit worse because the macroscopicness has got even bigger. We're entangled with the environment as well as being entangled with the cat. So the merit of the Schrodinger cat problem is that it brings to the fore differences between different interpretations of quantum mechanics. Now, the measurement problem is isomorphic to the cat problem. Here, in a highly abbreviated form, is the outline of the measurement problem. And you're not seeing one of the equations there. Oh, dear. Well, the essence of the measurement problem, I also assume you all know what it is because it's been stated so often. We want to measure some microscopic observable whose eigenvalues are q sub I, and we interact with an apparatus whose pointer position is capital A sub I, and the interaction is devised such that there is a correlation set up between the initial value of the microscopic thing that we want to measure with the macroscopic pointer position, which is the result of the measurement. And of course, the linearity of the Schrodinger equation just says that for an initial state that is a superposition of two microscopic states, that's psi equals q1 plus q2. I have to keep looking up here to see if you can read my equations because of the technology that's not quite faithful here. If the initial state is a superposition, then of course the final state is a superposition, and we inevitably get a coherent superposition of macroscopically distinct pointer positions. And once again, of course, decoherence is irrelevant to this. The relevance of it is that for some interpretations, this is a real problem. It's a little hard to see how an individual interpretation of the state vector would make much sense under these circumstances, and people who try to maintain individual interpretations frequently get caught up in what Einstein called unnatural theoretical conceptions, or whatever his exact words were. In an ensemble interpretation, well, I may get some comments from the audience to the effect that there's still a problem, but it's certainly a less severe problem, because in an ensemble interpretation, all that's expected of you is that you predict correctly the probabilities, and of course the ensemble interpretation does that. Now, an objection may be raised, and often is. Somebody says, hey, but you said in the ensemble interpretation, it's okay to have a macroscopic superposition of pointer positions, but we never observe microscopic objects to be in a superposition state. My answer to that objection is, they say, how do you know? Did you ever look? What would you see if you did look? Now, let's take a simple example here, a coherent superposition of two non-overlapping wave packets. So phi of x is supposed to be a narrow wave packet, and then we add to it phi of x plus a, the same wave packet displaced by a distance a, which is big enough that they don't overlap. So we got a coherent superposition of the two. The position probability density, by squaring that wave function, is indeed just the sum of the two position probabilities, because by construction there was no overlap. So it looks like you can't tell whether it's a coherent superposition or an incoherent mixture, but that's just because you're looking at the wrong thing. If you look instead at the momentum probability density, or indeed any probability, the probability of anything that doesn't commute with the position, I'm trying to position this so that you can see it properly, In the momentum representation, of course, the displacement operator is the exponential, e to the ip dot a. And if a is a macroscopic distance, then you're going to have a very, very fine interference pattern here. Very fine indeed. In fact, Mark Silverman, in a book he wrote not too long ago, estimated that for some kind of a modestly small macroscopic system, the wavelength of the interference pattern would be smaller than the diameter of an elementary particle. In other words, in principle, there's an interference pattern, but you can't see it because it's too damn small. The only thing decoherence does for you is to wipe out something that was too fine-grained for you to observe it anyhow. So that's why I say decoherence has very little to say about the measurement problem that's of any use. Now, it may be worthwhile to say something about what the ensemble interpretation is and what it is not, because misinterpretations are possible. So again, let's see if that's readable. Pretty good, I think. The ensemble is the set of all systems that have been or can be prepared in the appropriate state. It may involve separate preparations of different copies of the system, or it may involve repeated preparations of a single copy of the system. That's not an important detail. And the role of the state, that is, the state vector, state operator, wave function, however we represent it mathematically, the role of the state is to generate probability distributions for any and all observables. And as I say in finer print there, you could even go so far as to identify the state with the collection of probabilities. I don't insist that you go that far, but it would certainly be permissible to do so. Here are some misinterpretations that I sometimes run into. First one, if the state vector is a superposition of eigenstates of some quantity, let's say energy eigenstates, just for a particular example, then the ensemble is not to be thought of as an ensemble of systems, each of which is in the energy eigenstate. The ensemble is not an ensemble of energy eigenstates or anything like that. It's an ensemble of physical systems that have been prepared physically in a certain way, and they have certain statistical distributions of their observables, which can be determined on measurement. It's not to be thought of that the individual members of the ensemble have their own private wave function. Second misconception, if we're dealing with a mixed state with a statistical operator rho, that's a mixture of certain pure states, it is not to be thought that the ensemble is an ensemble of systems, each of which belongs to one of the pure states. There are situations in which you form a mixture precisely by making pure states, mixing them, but that's not the generic case, and you shouldn't think that that's necessarily that case. The state vector is not an element of reality. That is to say, I reject the extreme ontic position. But the state vector, on the other hand, does not represent knowledge. I also reject the extreme epistemic position. These are all very old arguments. And although I can't see the audience very well, I detect some reflection from the audience's faces that why is he telling us this old stuff that we've heard so many times. There are more arguments in favor of the ensemble interpretations, which are based on much more modern research. And one of them involves quantum classical correspondence. It is not obvious how you're going to get classical things coming out of quantum mechanics, in part because the mathematical apparatus is so different. The basic concepts of classical mechanics are, of course, positions, velocities, and so on of the individual particles. The basic mathematical concept of quantum mechanics are state vectors, are Feynman probability amplitudes, self-adjoint operators that represent observables, and things like that. Very different. And how do we find the common ground? What do we pick in quantum mechanics that has as its limit something classical? Not an obvious question. A question that doesn't have a completely obvious answer, I should say. And the way you go about it is influenced by your interpretation of the quantum state. If you adopt an individual interpretation of the quantum state, you'll be led to what I call Ehrenfest correspondence, because it's based on Ehrenfest theorem. And in this notion of correspondence, the motion of the centroid of a quantum mechanical wave packet is compared to an individual classical trajectory. Most quantum mechanics books, stop at that point. Mine is the exception, of course. If, on the other hand, you adopt an ensemble interpretation of quantum mechanics, then you'll be led to what I call Liouville correspondence, although Mr. Liouville didn't really have anything to do with it, because you compare quantum probabilities with classical probabilities, and the classical probabilities, of course, are defined in phase space, and they obey Liouville's equation. So there's these two criteria of correspondence. Regardless of whether you adopt one interpretation of quantum mechanics or not, I'd like to stress that it's very important that you distinguish between these two notions of correspondence, because they lead to quite different conclusions about what is the domain of the classical limit and when the classical limit should be violated. Most people make the distinction now, but I do know some prominent papers in which the author has failed to make this distinction, much to the detriment of what he has to say. So the merits of the individual versus ensemble interpretation are clarified, at least, by considering the classical limit of quantum mechanics. Here, in brief, is Ehrenfest's theorem in its simplest possible form. That is, for a system of one degree of freedom, we have a Hamiltonian, which consists of kinetic energy plus potential energy. We take the Heisenberg equations of motion that says the rate of change of the position operator is given by the momentum operator divided by the mass. The rate of change of the momentum operator is given by the force operator, where force is just the negative gradient of potential. We then take the average in some state, get these equations here that says the rate of change of average position is average momentum over mass. Rate of change of average momentum is average force. And the crucial step is the one which is less clear up above. So let's see if I can get it clearer. OK, that's better. This is the crucial point. If the average force is approximately equal to the force evaluated at the average position, then these equations here become identical with the classical Hamilton's equations. And we'll find that the averages, or the centroids of the quantum wave packet, will obey the classical equations and trace out a classical orbit. Evidently, this will be true if the wave packet is sufficiently narrow. Their problems with that are that, well, why should the initial state be narrow? And even if the initial state isn't narrow, why should it stay narrow? Well, we can clarify things by calculating the corrections to Ehrenfest's theorem. The way to do that is expand about the centroid. The operator delta Q is the position operator minus the average position. The operator delta P is the momentum operator minus the average position. And we substitute those into the equations of motion and doing this Taylor expansion in the deviation operators. And what we find is if the correction terms are absent, then we just have the classical equations for the centroid. That's Ehrenfest's theorem. If the state is narrow enough that you can neglect the correction terms, then yeah, the state evolves on a classical orbit. These corrections, however, are not primarily quantum mechanical in their origin. One way to suspect that, at least, is that they only depend on the width of the state, the mean square width of the state. There's no explicit dependence on H bar. There's a weak dependence in H bar hidden in there because it's hidden in the quantum dynamics. But by far the largest portion of the corrections to Ehrenfest's theorem are not quantum mechanical at all in their origin. And you can see this because Ehrenfest's theorem has a perfect classical analog. We do all the same things, except that we do it in classical mechanics. We take our average using a classical probability distribution. Q average sub c is the classical average position using the Liouville probability distribution. We get the equation of motion, and they have exactly the same form that the centroid of the probability distribution follows the classical orbit if the higher order correction terms are negligible. If they're not negligible, then it does. And the form of these terms is the same in that it involves only the centroid, it involves only the variance, the mean squared width of the state. So this is one way of seeing that the Ehrenfest theorem isn't really the criterion for classicality, because the corrections to Ehrenfest theorem really aren't quantum mechanical in origin. And this is borne out by a lot of numerical calculations as well. Okay, here I summarize then some of the weaknesses of Ehrenfest correspondence as a criterion of classicality. I guess I already mentioned some of those. The corrections to Ehrenfest theorem depend only on the width of the state. They have no systematic dependence on H-bar, which is a clue that they're not really quantum mechanical in origin. Ehrenfest theorem fails when the state width grows sufficiently large. Now, in Ehrenfest time, it was thought that for a macroscopic object, it would take the age of the universe for that to happen. But they didn't know about chaotic dynamics. It can happen a whole lot faster if you have chaotic dynamics. And in fact, for the tumbling motion of Hyperion, which is a satellite of Saturn, I believe, it's a non-spherical object, and its tumbling is chaotic. And it has a Lyapunov exponent of a few years, such that this is Wojciech Zurek made this estimate. In about 20 years, the Ehrenfest theorem for Hyperion would break down. And if Ehrenfest theorem was a criterion for classicality, then that astronomical object up there would be quantum mechanical long since. Zurek tried to explain this away with decoherence. I happen to disagree with him on that. But he at least deserves credit for pointing out this rather striking example that Ehrenfest theorem can't be the proper criterion for classicality. I stress here at the bottom here that the average that I talked about in the quantum case, it didn't have to be a pure state average. It could have been a mixed state average. What decoherence does for us is that it changes the pure states into mixed states. It does not make them narrower. So contrary to Zurek, I assert that decoherence doesn't solve this problem. The advantage of Liouville correspondence, in which we compare quantum probabilities to classical ensemble probabilities, first of all, the quantum classical differences, if you compare quantum states with classical ensembles rather than quantum states with individual classical orbits, as we did in the Ehrenfest case, the ensemble quantum classical differences are not very sensitive to the width of the initial state. Exactly the opposite of what we found in the Ehrenfest case. The ensemble quantum classical differences scale with H-bar in a systematic and interesting way, which is certainly suggestive of a quantum origin. And the ensemble quantum classical differences go to zero as H-bar goes to zero in some appropriately defined dimensionless sense. And decoherence is not necessary for this to happen. I'll just give you a little taste of what some of the results of this theory is. It's a composite sketch of results derived from work of myself and my students, published over several years in several papers. And it's composite in the sense that numerical calculations have been done on different model systems by different techniques. And they don't all look exactly like this, but this is sort of the main qualitative feature. So what I plot here is Q minus C is just symbolically something quantum minus something classical. And it's on a log scale, plotted versus time. And it's also for a chaotic state. So a straight line on a semi-log plot is exponential growth. The quantum classical distance, quantum classical differences initially grow exponentially. Eventually, they saturate, and there's a bit of fluctuation around there, but they saturate. In the short time exponential growth regime, they scale with h bar squared, which probably is no surprise. What's the simplest possible dependence you could have on h bar? It's really h bar squared. H bar to the first power is ruled out by some symmetry considerations. The more interesting thing is once you get to the saturation regime, it depends on what kind of a thing you're looking at, how it scales. Coarse-grained things, like the averages of observables, if you take the difference between quantum average and classical average of some observable, that scales approximately as h bar to the 2/3. If you look at something more fine-scaled, like the difference in probability distributions, the integral of the absolute value of the difference between the quantum probability distribution and the classical probability distribution, that goes to zero more slowly and is something like h bar to the 1/3. If anybody asks me how accurate those figures 2/3 and 1/3 are, I have to be frank and say one significant figure. It's only numerical calculations. It's not proven analytically, but it's these results of this sort have been obtained for more than one physical model, and it's very suggestive of a pattern. The role of decoherence is comparatively minor. If we look at the coarse grain quantities, decoherence is essentially irrelevant. It makes no significant difference at all. In the case of fine scale quantities, like the difference in the probability distributions, decoherence does make a difference because what it does is wipe out the very fine scale oscillations in the probability. And so if you put decoherence in, that exponent 1/3 would probably change to something closer to 2/3. I'm not sure. But the point that I want to make is that quantum classical differences from the ensemble point of view do scale to zero with h bar, and you don't need decoherence to achieve this result. Decoherence is not responsible for the appearance of the classical world. So here's summarizes the conclusions of this part of the talk. The classical limit of a quantum state is an ensemble of classical trajectories rather than a single classical trajectory. And the role of the quantum state is as a generator of probabilities for an ensemble of similarly prepared systems. But even if you agree with me on this, or if you don't agree with me, and, well, I'll hear from you in the question period, accept it for the sake of argument at this point, we're not finished because what kind of probability? There are many different kinds of probability, and that's what I want to address next. In the last few years, I've studied probability theory, and there's all sorts of views, particularly in the philosophy of science community, but I found it useful to classify them into three major groups. In the first group, we have ensemble and frequency theories. I list that group first because it's probably the oldest one in scientific application than the ones that you're most familiar with. Everybody makes use of a frequency of interpretation of probability at some time or other. The problem with the old frequency interpretation is that there's no guarantee that the limit exists. And it's been largely replaced by what I call an ensemble theory, characterized by the name of Kolmogorov, who represents probabilities in terms of measurable sets. That's a very well-established and very familiar branch of probability theories. The second branch I call inferential probabilities. Some people call them epistemic probabilities. So I have my own reasons for preferring the word inferential over epistemic, but that's not so important. The best reference I know is Ed Jayne's posthumous book called Probability Theory, The Logic of Science. And there's two major branches of the inferential probability. One is the objective version, in which probabilities are seen as a form of logical inference that's weaker than deduction. If the probabilities all were zeros and ones, it would just be deductive inference. And the other is the subjective version, in which probability is used to describe incomplete knowledge and to describe degrees of reasonable beliefs. Those of you who have heard or read my previous talks on this subject will notice that my classification is evolving a bit. In particular, I've had some trouble deciding exactly where to place the subjective theory, and I've decided, as of now, to place it alongside the objective logical inference theory, because the mathematical applications are so very, very similar. In fact, in Jayne's book, he goes from objective to subjective without even giving a clue that he realizes that he's changed from one to the other. They're so closely related. And the third is introduced in the scientific context by Karl Popper, propensity. Propensity is a form of causality that is weaker than determinism. So it's a natural way to look at probability if you believe that quantum mechanics like alpha decay and things like that describes really indeterministic processes, which can only be described probabilistically. And the other interpretations of probability theory don't seem to fit quite so well. There are some differences, some significant differences between category 2 and category 3, the inferential probability and the propensity interpretation, propensity probability. And that is, whereas in inferential probability, you can the notation P A slash B means the probability of A given B, or probability of A conditional on B. A and B can be any propositions whatsoever. It's a very general theory. And this is true whether you adopt the objective version or the subjective version. They're equally general in their range of applicability. In the propensity theory, it specializes to indeterministic events. And the second argument, S, must describe the state of the system, or it must describe a sequence of events that corresponds to state preparation. So there's some restrictions on the applicability of Bayes' theorem. The equations are the same in all versions of probability theory, but the subject matter is a bit different. I don't have time to go into this in any more detail. Now, where does quantum probability fit? Well, what is quantum probability? I use the term quantum probability to refer to the kind of probabilities that are calculated from the familiar formulas that we all know, like psi of x squared. Probability density for the position. It's the probability that the particle will be at the position x, or if you prefer, will be found to be at x if you try to measure it. Or the second expression, inner product of an eigenvector, a sub n, with the state vector psi squared, gives you the probability that if you measure the corresponding observable a, you'll get the result, the eigenvector a sub n. A more general expression involves a density matrix or statistical operator rho, and E sub omega is a projection operator that projects onto the spectrum of observables. That's the most general expression. Anyway, I use the term quantum probability to mean those probabilities that are calculated from the quantum formulas that we all know about. And of course, quantum probabilities are not the only kinds of probability that there is. Some attributes of quantum probability. First of all, it's always conditional on the preparation of a state. In those formulas there, you have a state function. Either the wave function psi or the state operator rho, that has to be given. And it's given by, presumably, a physical operation of state preparation having taken place beforehand, either deliberately by an experimenter or natural process in nature. But in any case, the preparation of the state is a necessary antecedent. It asserts the probability of occurrence of events, such as individual measurement results. These events are indeterministic, or at least unpredictable, not merely unknown. Indeterministic is not quite a synonym for unpredictable, and it's certainly more powerful than merely unknown. The above characteristics describe the world, not someone's knowledge of the world. Therefore, quantum probabilities, I say, are objective rather than subjective. The quantum mechanics is about something happening in the world. It's not about something happening in my head. If you compare these properties with those of propensity, which I didn't have much time to dwell on, you find that quantum probabilities fit the propensity interpretation very well. Now, I said then that the distinctively or specifically quantum probabilities should be interpreted as propensities. I did not say that those are the only kind of probabilities that can ever be used in the context of quantum mechanics. I've occasionally heard people who ought to know better make the statement that their own favorite interpretation of probability should always be used, and I deplore naive sentiments to that effect. Each of these three classes of probability has their legitimate use, and anybody who says, mine is the only correct theory, mine is the only true religion, well, you can correspondingly discount what such a person says. The frequency and ensemble interpretations I don't have to justify because everybody uses them, including myself. In fact, the propensity interpretation of probability can even be regarded as a necessary foundation for the frequency interpretation to make sense. The relationship between inferential probabilities and quantum probabilities, however, it needs a little bit more elaboration. And I think the best way to do this is by means of a simple example in which both objective and subjective probabilities play an essential but different role. Again, can we read? I think so, mostly. All right. Here's the problem. We prepare a photon in a certain polarization state. It's the vertical polarization state. So the state vector psi is vertical polarization. We then tell Alice that the polarization is either vertical or horizontal. We tell Bob that it's either vertical or horizontal, or plus 45 degrees or minus 45 degrees. So Bob and Alice have different states of knowledge because they weren't around when the state was prepared, and we told them different amounts of information about it. In the basis formed by the vertical and horizontal polarization states, there's a density matrix for each of these states, the vertical polarization, the horizontal, the plus 45 degrees, and the minus 45 degrees. Alice and Bob have incomplete knowledge, and they can, if they wish, calculate a subjective density matrix. Alice will say, well, 50% probability of vertical, 50% probability of horizontal, and she gets the diagonal density matrix with one half in it. Bob will say, 25% vertical, 25% horizontal, 25% plus 45 degrees, 25% minus 45 degrees, and he'll get exactly the same subjective density matrix, I call it. Nevertheless, Bob and Alice have different states of knowledge, and they will make different predictions on the basis of that. Contrast this with quantum probabilities, as I define them, quantum probabilities that are calculated from the quantum formulas. If you know the density matrix, you calculate all the quantum probabilities. Nothing more needs to be known. States of knowledge are different things. Well, let's suppose we perform an experiment. We use a filter that separates out horizontal from vertical, and we determine, of course, that the polarization of the photon is vertical. We already knew that, but Bob and Alice didn't know it. When the result of this experiment is known, Alice then correctly infers that the initial state must have been vertical polarization, because she knew it was either vertical or horizontal. The experiment rules out horizontal, therefore it must have been vertical. Bob, however, doesn't know as much as that. He knows that it can't be horizontal, but it could be three out of four possibilities. He can make an estimate using Bayes' theorem, which I'll just go over very quickly. I think I'm probably running out of time. Bayes' theorem basically is a very well-known theorem of probability theory, which allows you to calculate the probability of X given Y in terms of the probability of Y given X and some other quantities. And in this particular case, the Ys are the possible measurement results. We did a measurement in which either we got the result vertical or horizontal. That's what our apparatus was capable of giving us. The x's are the possible initial states, and for Bob, it's the choice of one of the four, vertical, horizontal, plus 45, minus 45. And the likelihoods, this probability here, the py conditional on x and other information, is called the likelihood technically, and those probabilities are just standard quantum probabilities. If we assume that the state was vertical, then the probability of getting the vertical result in the measurement would be 1. If we assume the state was horizontal, the probability of getting that is 0. If we assume the state is plus 45 degree polarization, then the probability of getting the observed measurement result is 1/2, and likewise for minus 45. So putting all that together, Bob comes up with his final state of knowledge. He doesn't know what the state was, but he sharpened up his information. He now says, well, there's probability of 1/2 that the initial state was vertically polarized. It can't be horizontally polarized. There's a probability of 1/4 that it's either plus 45 degrees or minus 45 degrees. He could, if he wishes, combine this to form a subjective density matrix, 1/2 of the vertical, 1/4 of the plus 45, 1/4 of the minus 45, and he gets this density matrix here that's got diagonal elements 3/4 and 1/4. The interpretation of that, what I call a subjective density matrix, is not completely obvious. and let me make some remarks about it. First of all, it's not Bob's estimate of the final state after the system. He does not believe that the final state of the system after measurement was that density matrix. He knows that it was one of the three, vertical, plus 45, or minus 45. There is a sense in which it's his best estimate in terms of minimizing his expected error, but I won't go into that one. But the important thing is that it does not represent his state of belief. He does not believe that the initial state, or the final state for that matter, is given by this subjective density matrix. He believes that it was either vertical, or plus 45, or minus 45. In particular, it would be wrong to interpret this density matrix in the context of Bob's knowledge as being 75% vertical and 25% horizontal, because Bob already knows that there's zero chance that polarization was horizontal. The experiment told him that. So the point is that the density matrix does not represent Bob's knowledge. So here's the conclusion here. There is an objective state. It's determined by the result of a physical operation of state preparation. And in our example, it was the vertical polarization states. There may be both objective and subjective probabilities, or objective and subjective informations that are legitimately useful in the same problem. But what I want to stress is that they are both conceptually and numerically distinct. One is not the same as the other. The degrees of belief and the quantum probabilities are two entirely different things. Well, maybe not entirely different. Maybe they're related, but they're different anyway. In particular, observers who have different states of knowledge may nevertheless assign the same subjective density matrix. Therefore, it is not correct to say that the density matrix represents a state of knowledge. So if I just give a general summary of what my main points were, the quantum state describes an ensemble of similarly prepared systems. The state vector, or density matrix, if you're dealing with a mixed state, is a generator of probabilities for all of the observables of the system. The specifically quantum probabilities, that's the things like psi squared, these should be interpreted as propensities. They have a fairly close connection to frequencies through the law of large numbers, but there are well-known problems to define probability in terms of frequency, and the propensity interpretation gets around that. Inferential probabilities, whether you take the objective version or the subjective version, have a legitimate place in quantum theory, just as they have a little legitimate place in other branches of science. In particular, they're very useful in information theory, either classical or quantum. They're very useful in cryptography, either classical or quantum, and probably many other branches that I don't list. But they should not be confused with the specific quantum probabilities, which are different sorts of things. I guess my time is up, so I'll have to stop here and give you some time for questions.
Questions?
Get out of the bright light so I can see people with their hands up. You're going to recognize the question. Sorry, Bob.
Thank you. One thing that's always puzzled me about the Bohr-Einstein correspondence is that, Einstein favored an ensemble interpretation, it struck me that Bohr did too. It's just that the ensemble was to be understood differently from the way that Einstein was understanding it. Do you think that your version of an ensemble interpretation leans towards Einstein's view, to Bohr's view, or do you want to stake out a third position?
Well, I once said before in a similar context that the problem of interpreting quantum mechanics should not be identified with the problem of interpreting Bohr, because the former problem probably has a solution, but the second problem probably does not. I think I'm certainly closer in spirit to Einstein. I don't claim to understand Bohr. I find much of what he says incomprehensible. Sometimes I find it to be absolutely correct. Sometimes I find it to be entirely wrong.
This might be the same exact question, but what's your attitude toward the hidden variables program, and what do you think of the de Broglie-Bohm theory? And maybe, again, the same question, but in a slightly more general way, if I take an ensemble interpretation of the quantum state, then some people think that there's then a further question which is raised, namely, what is the precise, you know, identity out in reality of all of these different elements of the ensemble? Do you, is that a question that you think is a legitimate question into which you have maybe some speculative ideas, or do you think it's a legitimate question and you don't know how to answer it, or do you think it's for some reason or other not valid or appropriate or, you know, whatever?
I think it's a legitimate question, though they don't really have an answer. There are some people, I said quantum mechanics describes an ensemble of similarly prepared systems. Okay, but the world consists of individuals. It doesn't consist of ensembles. So wouldn't it be nice if we could have a theory that does describe ensembles? Some people try to do it, people like Shelley Goldstein and Phil Perl, and I don't think I'm opposed in principle to their work in any way. I may have specific criticisms of it on specific points, but because I I distinguish between what quantum mechanics does and what it doesn't do. And what it doesn't do is not something that can be remedied merely by changing the interpretation. Something has to be added to the theory or replaced in the theory. So I'm sympathetic towards people who try to go beyond it, even though I may criticize them on technical grounds.
On the same point again, I think, I'm not sure why you see there to be a problem with viewing the ensemble as an element of reality. I mean, you can think of very clear cases. For example, in medicine, you have randomized controlled trials, which are precisely these state preparations. You prepare all these systems in the same way. You let them evolve. You make measurements. And what you're dealing with is the ensemble itself. That's the fundamental thing. So, and it's not an element of reality. Nobody would make such a claim in that case. What exactly is the problem with these ensembles in the quantum context?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question here. Maybe if I go to, if I pursue the question of medical diagnosis, and the doctor tells me that 75% of the people that present your symptoms that you came to me with today have cancer, I'm not terribly interested in the ensemble. I'm interested in what's the probability that I have cancer? And that's it's a different question. And the answer to it is pursued in somewhat different ways. I'm not sure whether that's what you're getting at.
No. I mean, the point was that it's perfectly reasonable to take ensembles as elements of reality. There's nothing wrong with ensembles.
No, there's nothing wrong with ensembles, but ensembles are conceptual, theoretical constructs. Well, individual objects are real. That's what I'm saying. That's all. And therefore, a theory that can only make predictions about ensembles is incomplete in a certain sense of the word incomplete. That's all.
But I've just given an example.
It's not an objection to the theory. It's a limitation to its scope. That's all. A statistical theory is very, very useful and very, very valid. I'm not denigrating statistical theories.
So I'd like to cordially challenge your last example, turning from philosophy to physics here, regarding Alice and Bob. You've said that the quantum state cannot describe a state of knowledge, because in this case, Alice and Bob have different knowledge, and yet they ascribe the same state. My challenge to that, my complaint with that, is that the quantum state describes a particular system at a particular time. And in this case, in the example you've given, Alice and Bob have exactly the same beliefs about that system. What you've demonstrated is they have different beliefs, different knowledge, about a different system, which is the one that prepared that system, or another system prepared exactly the same way. And if we want the mathematics to give us the right result, which is that, yes, indeed, they do ascribe different density matrices, then we need to enlarge our Hilbert space and look at that system. So I'm not convinced that it really says anything against the epistemic view.
Well, I distinguish between what I called an objective quantum state and a subjective state, which was somebody's belief or partial knowledge about that state. suppose we have a state preparation apparatus, which is reproducible, but it just came off the assembly line and has never been calibrated, and therefore we don't know whether it really prepares the state that the spec sheet says it's supposed to prepare. We can perform an experiment and determine objectively whether or not it prepares the state that the spec sheet said it was supposed to prepare. And there's no room for subjectivity here. There's a right answer. In the case of Alice and Bob, they had incomplete knowledge. I deliberately constructed that case so that they'd estimate the same density matrix. But I could have given you another observer, Carol, who had a third set of information, and she would have come up with a different density matrix from Alice and Bob. And experiment would show that at least one of them was wrong. So there is a difference here. I'm not sure if that answers your point.
Perhaps we can take it up later.
So there was actually a request, which I forgot about recently, that when you ask a question, if you could just introduce yourself ahead of time, that would be very useful.
Okay, well, I'll be the first one to do that. Mike Towler, Cambridge University. I think it all boils down to whether you believe a state vector is a complete description of the quantum state or not. If you do, then...
Would you repeat that? I didn't quite hear your words.
Oh, sorry. I'll put my mouth closer to the microphone. It all boils down to whether you believe the state vector is a complete description of the quantum state or not. If you do, then this is equivalent to the Copenhagen interpretation, because then you have no way of distinguishing between the different members of the ensemble. So it must be the case, then, that the ensemble interpretation is a hidden variables theory, but you're just refusing to say what the hidden variables are. And then I think you have to say that the theory is incomplete, because then you're not saying what measurement is. Is a measurement revealing a pre-existing property of particles or whatever, or is it not?
Well, you're asking...
Is it a hidden variables theory, as I'm claiming?
The ensemble interpretation, per se, is not a hidden variable theory, but it is compatible philosophically with hidden variable theories underlying it. I would put it that way. And of course, once you go to that level, then there are a whole bunch of questions that I didn't address, like the ones that you alluded to. As to whether the state vector is a complete description of a quantum state, well, we have to define more carefully what we mean by a state. In my book, I sort of talk about this a little bit more in terms of a state is an equivalent class of probability distributions, or more operationally, a state is a result of certain repeatable physical procedures that you can do that will generate something with stable probability distributions. And in that sense, both the pure state vector and the mixed state density matrix are complete descriptions of their respective quantum state. They, of course, do not describe at a hidden variable level. They don't attempt to.
Use the word preparation a lot in the talk. And in particular, you justified the objectivity of quantum states by saying quantum states are objective because they come from physical preparations. I think my question is, where do preparations come from?
Well, preparations are well-defined experimental procedures. They could just be sort of laboratory cookbook procedures, of course, but they are well-defined.
So they're well-defined and they're...
But actually...
Experimental procedures.
Yeah.
Do we need experiments to have preparations?
I'm sorry?
In the days of the universe, before there were experiments.
No.
Unless the universe itself is an experiment.
No, this is something that John Bell emphasized, and I agree with him, that we are overemphasizing the role of human experiments in our interpretations of quantum mechanics, and we should formulate the theory in such a way that applies to nature. It doesn't just apply to contrived things done in a laboratory, and I'm as guilty as the next person in overemphasizing contrived experiments. I would regard something that happens in the core of the sun, for example, as a state preparation for the solar neutrinos, even though I'm not knowledgeable enough to describe it to you in laboratory terms.
So then might you just have used the word initial condition instead? Or is there a conceptual distinction?
Certainly it fulfills the role of supplying the initial conditions. That's one of its important functional roles. I'm not sure, I haven't thought about this long enough to say whether state preparation is importantly different from initial condition or not, but they're very closely related.
And if I could just ask you to introduce yourself before you ask your question.
Jocelyn Bruckner from University of Vienna. You told that the classical limit is an ensemble of classical trajectories rather than a single classical trajectory. But as we experience in the like everyday life, which we need to be some kind of classical limit, single trajectories, is there any way to get out of a quantum theory these single trajectories? That would be my first question. Second one is of different kind. It seems to me that you can distinguish different states of knowledge. One would be the state of knowledge of your preparation, the other states of knowledge about the future measurement results that you might perform. So it seems that you support this view of propensities, and it was always for me very close to the state of knowledge about your future measurement results. Would you like to comment?
Well, the two questions are totally different, so let me go to the first one. The first question was, I got into the second question. What was the first question? Oh, the classical limit, right, okay. So we observe single classical trajectories. So where do they come from theoretically? That's a difficult and interesting question that I've thought about, and I'm not entirely satisfied with the answer to this point. But let me put it this way. Suppose all we knew about classical mechanics was the Liouville equation. We didn't know Newton's equation. We didn't know Hamilton's equations. We know the equation of motion for a probability distribution of an ensemble in phase space. And that's all we know. How could we separate that ensemble into individual trajectories? That is, there's our initial probability distribution here. It evolves into that probability distribution there. How can we take a point from that ensemble and match it with a point in that ensemble? Well, we know how to do it in principle mathematically in Liouville's equation, because the Liouville equation can be solved by what's called the method of characteristics. If you take each point and evolve it according to Hamilton's equation, the Liouville function is constant along that point, along the trajectory of that point. That's one way of expressing Liouville's theorem. So if we were a group of people who knew of classical mechanics only through Liouville's equation and never heard of Newton and Hamilton, we would eventually discover them mathematically. Now, go to quantum mechanics. What is the quantum analog of the Liouville distribution? Even that is not 100% clear. I would say the Hassemi distribution is the best candidate. It obeys an equation of motion also, but you can't solve it by the method of characteristics. It doesn't have that kind of a solution. So the answer of how we get individual trajectories out of quantum mechanics, I mean, we get an ensemble of trajectories, of course, but how do we separate out the individual trajectories from the cloud of the ensemble is much more difficult. And although I have some qualitative hand-waving ideas as to how it might go, it's not to the point that I'd be willing to write a paper on it yet. Okay, that was the first question. I don't know. The second one. Well, there is a great deal of duality or correspondence between the different interpretations of probability theory. They all use the same equations, so it's often possible to take, let's say, a statement in the frequency theory and translate that into a statement in the ensemble theory and translate that into a statement of the inductive inference theory. What I would say is that it's not really a matter of translation. These are different statements. They're analogous statements, but they're not the same thing. So I would say no, propensity doesn't describe a state of knowledge, although for every problem in which I talk about the propensity of something happening indeterministically in a future event, you could make a related statement about somebody's knowledge. They're different statements. There are so many cases in which the correspondence between the objective and subjective statements are so close that there's a temptation to say, well, the differences aren't important. It's only a matter of words. And the purpose of my example here with objective and subjective probabilities in the same problem is to say, well, that's not always the case. There are situations in which the objective probabilities are well defined, the subjective probabilities are well defined, and they are different.
Could I follow up on the question about propensity? You said that you thought quantum probabilities were propensities, that indeterminism was not mere unpredictability. But I didn't quite follow what the argument was. So let me ask it this way. Why do you dismiss the possibility that there's an interpretation of quantum mechanics in terms of hidden variables?
Oh, I didn't dismiss it. Let me finish.
So the quantum state represents a distribution over the physical states. And the reason that we see indeterminism is because we don't know the physical state.
Okay.
And then the interpretation
I actually said indeterminism and or unpredictability. So, I mean, if you have chaotic dynamics of the hidden variables, it will be deterministic, but it'll still be unpredictable. So I allow for that. That's all right. I don't disagree with that as a possibility.
So it's not necessarily a propensity.
Strict indeterminism isn't necessary, no. It's just that it's a very popular belief about things like radioactive decay.
Hi, Brian LaCour, University of Texas at Austin. In your ensemble interpretation, do you take the ensemble to be completely determined by the quantum state, or does that ensemble depend in any way on the set of measurements that are to be taken on that quantum state?
As I described it, the ensemble is just determined by the quantum state, but you can describe more complicated things like pre and post selection. Akira Aronoff is very good at this, and so you can do other things. I sort of did quantum probabilities at their textbook level. Other things can be defined.
Okay, well, in that case, how do you get around problems like the Cook and Specker theorem, where you have contextuality?
Well, at the level of anything I said today, that problem hasn't been addressed yet. But that's a problem for hidden variable theories. And like I said, the ensemble interpretation is not in any way antagonistic to hidden variable theories. When you come to proposing a specific hidden variable theory, then criticisms will have to be leveled against it on its own merit, and the Cochin-Specker theorem is a very powerful one. I don't think the Cochin-Specker theorem bears on what I had to say today. If I'd gone chapter two and said, okay, here's my version of a hidden variable theory, which I haven't done, then you'd be entitled to bring up the Cochin-Specker theorem and say, how do you deal with that? That's not what I did today.
So from your point of view, an ensemble is really just a mechanism for constructing a probability measure.
You could put it that way, I suppose.
I can take an infinite sequence of ensemble members and construct from that a particular probability distribution, and the interpretation of what that means is left open.
Yeah, I'd put it a little differently. I'd say an ensemble is sort of a conceptual realization of a probability distribution, but I think we're saying much the same thing.
Okay. Well, let's end it there for now. We're meeting back here at 2 after lunch, which will be served upstairs in the bistro. I think they have sandwiches for us today. Most days we'll get better fare, but today it's sandwiches. So let's thank Leslie again.